Hey everybody, I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here with Polarity One, Polar Levine.
Good morning, good afternoon, good night.
In the studio for another program of scintillating discussion and debate about topics of importance. We're going to be talking about the stop and frisk decision that came down this past week with Donna Lieberman, the executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, and hoping to shed a little more light on what the decision meant and what it means now in terms of the continuing struggle to stop abusive police practices in New York and by extension around the country. So we're going to get to that very soon. But first, you know, I'm really shaken today with the events in Cairo. So hopeful. The Arab Spring seemed so hopeful a few years back, and now look what's happened. A military regime has essentially taken over. The military apparently willing to not only arrest and detain an elected president whose politics they don't like, but also to try to bust up and kill nonviolent protesters. That happened today. I don't know what the death count is. It was 528. The last time I saw, but thousands of people wounded. And now the Egyptian army has been given live ammunition and basically told to shoot to kill. Martial law is in place. It sounds like Mubarak all over again. And the people of Egypt are planning protests and marches, which may or may not lead to more bloodshed. So this is something to worry about. Britain called in the Egyptian ambassador in London, chastised him, criticized him. But the United States has issued a statement of concern, but has not made any change of policy and is still supporting the Egyptian army, which has had a long history of very close relations with the American army. So these events may have been partially made in the USA. I've read lots of reports suggesting an American involvement, perhaps even an Israeli involvement. I've read reports that the military leadership there are basically neocons in their outlook and want to stop popular democracy from getting a foothold in Egypt and try to erode the foothold that it already has. That's not to say there weren't problems with Morsi's leadership. Certainly were. People were in revolt against him and against the Muslim Brotherhood. But the events that have come down since then have been shocking, and they should shock everybody to be extremely outspoken about all of this, because what we're seeing again is a massacre on a tremendous scale. I don't know how you feel about this, Polar, but
yeah, well, not having any information about one thing or another. One thing that it does show is that it seems to be sort of the playbook for a lot of revolutions. I went back and looked at the French Revolution, and it's pretty much exactly the same, except that Morsi didn't kill 16,000 people, but it wound up being the same thing, because there was two main factions in the opposition to begin with, and then once they win, those factions are going to either come together or they're going to separate.
Well, this is history, you know, revolution, counter-revolution. That's a cycle that we've seen many, many times before. But we still have to not just accept this as sort of historically, you know, kind of inevitable, but also to really talk about how we can support the people of Egypt who are fighting for some kind of democracy and have been sacrificing so much for it and are finding themselves now under the heel of a new leader who is acting in their interests. And it's very disturbing.
Yeah,
and
one of the most disturbing things to me is that the secular faction hooked up with the army. You know, instead of at least supporting the idea of democracy, they just gave it up right away. And that's what bothers me a lot.
It seemed like an unholy alliance. Okay, people, Danny Schechter here. This is News Dissector Radio, heard every week at this time on PRN-FM, the Progressive Radio Network. Now on to discuss stop and frisk.
First they're gonna stop and frisk, then they're gonna strip and search, they're gonna take you to Guantanamo and you'll disappear from the earth. They're gonna stop and frisk, then they're gonna strip and search. They're gonna take you to Guantanamo and you'll disappear from the earth. NDAA, you're taking our rights away. Everybody here, be careful what you say.
Hey!
Shh.
Yeah, that's Steve Baldwin. He's a fellow Occupy guitarist, and he's ever since the beginning of Occupy, Steve was always seen out there wherever more than three people were congregated. He was out there with his guitar, and that was a song that he wrote.
Okay, folks, well, we're trying to reach Donald Lieberman, who's on vacation on Cape Cod, so maybe the idea of being on time for a radio show is inconsistent with being on vacation on Cape Cod. We're going to keep trying to reach her. But, you know, the facts are, as you know, a judge has now ruled that stop and frisk is has violated people's rights. It's a complicated decision because it really doesn't completely get rid of the stop and frisk, but it says, look, there should be oversight, there should be other conditions, the police shouldn't have the basic power to assume that people are guilty of something. You know, it's like that movie about pre-crimes, you know, where people are essentially convicted or accused or arrested or apprehended on the basis of
the crime they're about to commit.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, on the legal side of things, if somebody clearly is a suspect of a crime that was committed, well, yeah, you know, you stop them and frisk them. So how many of those will be stopped and frisked in the course of a year under the Constitution? You know, maybe a handful, but how many thousands of people?
Well, over 100,000.
Yeah.
Here in New York City, this was a police practice that tended to take place in the outer boroughs, tended to impact primarily on people of color, blacks, Latinos, other minorities, not people in Midtown Manhattan, for the most part.
There was a lot of audio recorded evidence. It was recorded surreptitiously by cops recording their precinct captains, who were basically telling them, go out and do this, and I want numbers. It was mainly for the to support the effort of some asshole's career track, and that's primarily what it was about.
Well, also, I mean, the mayor's reaction to this decision was pretty shocking. I mean, he said,
really?
We were treated unfairly in the courts. This decision is wrong, and we're going to overturn it on appeal, essentially telling the judge to go stuff it, and the kind of arrogance for which Mr. Bloomberg is well known by people.
It was
who
very unfair.
Challenge him.
Yeah, he probably felt like he was being stopped and frisked.
Right, exactly. You know, the Daily Show had John Oliver did a rather brilliant take on the whole thing, comparing it to, you know, people essentially losing, you know, not only their rights, but you know, where guilt is assumed, you know, we're supposed to be innocent until we're proven guilty, not the other way around.
Yeah, well, you know, some of those recordings state very clearly that it wasn't even a presumed guilt. It was just do it. You see a bunch of, you know, African-American kids, Latinos standing there or sitting on a stoop. Just do it and we'll figure out a pretext for it later on.
Well, I mean, but let's put it in a larger context here. You know, poverty has grown dramatically in the city. Education has fallen, you know, if you will, dramatically in the city. There are very few jobs for young people. There's a way in which crime is built into a system. Crime goes up when unemployment goes up as well. So, you know, in the absence of social programs that could really help in this area, A police response has been called for. The cops feel justified in doing this because they can cite one or two cases where they actually found a weapon or something like this on somebody they've searched. But the bottom line of it all is, you know, creating a climate of fear in many communities and creating a suspicion of people of color. It's racist in many aspects of the way it's approached, even though the cops protested that. They say the judge, oh, my God, suggested there's racial profiling here. How dare her, you know? But nevertheless, the fact that a court and a judge wrote a very long and very thoughtful opinion about it, in fact, in my mind, that didn't really go far enough. Excuse me a second. I'm reaching for a number because if you have had experiences with Stop and Frisk, if you'd like to join us in conversation as we wait to try to hook up with Donna Lieberman, who's probably on the beach right now, 888-874-4888. The number again, 888-874-4888. And please call us if you're out of town. The toll-free number, 877-627-5065.
Well, maybe she's being stopped and frisked.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, this is something that the Civil Liberties Union has been battling on for such a long time. And to finally, through pressures by the Center for Constitutional Rights, the New York Civil Liberties Union, American Civil Liberties Union, finally to extract, you know, a kind of a little bit of justice here, a little bit of oversight by the courts of police practices that affect literally hundreds of thousands of people in terms of a mass, you know, kind of almost Gestapo-like action. It's taken so long and the media has done so little to really cover the realities and the experiences that people have had. That's the other side of this, where the police are assumed to be acting in our interests. The police are assumed to know what they're doing. The police are assumed to be in the crime-fighting business when, in many ways, they're in the crime-creation business, certainly.
Yeah. Well, sure. I mean, you're basically alienating the community, and they're not likely to work with the police in solving crime.
You have a situation where, I certainly respect police officers. I've met many who, I think are really socially concerned as well and understand these issues. But when you give a whole force of armed people not only the capacity to do this, but the encouragement to do this and, in fact, pressure to bring arrests and bring up the numbers of those arrested, almost as like those people who are, getting parking tickets at the end of the month, because there's a curfew, a quota, rather. This is what we've been dealing with in this city. And I think the fact that we have a decision by a judge who has looked at this closely, who has heard testimony on this, who has taken pains to write a long and thoughtful opinion about it, and to have her opinion simply dismissed by Mr. Kelly, the police commissioner, and Mayor Bloomberg, who are sitting as if they themselves are kind of unaccountable gods when it comes to these matters. We saw it with Occupy Wall Street, the complete contempt that they showed. And we now know through a lot of these disclosures about the national security state and the National Security Agency that clearly there was a federal hand, if not federal fingers, encouraging the New York police to collect information illegally on individuals, to create an environment of total intimidation, to crack down on the peaceful settlement, peaceful campground at Zuccotti Park, and a court later
spy on mosques.
Yeah, and the courts later found that the police did violate people's rights and did pay a certain amount of compensation, to the people whose rights and whose property was violated. And the people who were talking about this were considered by a lot of people in the media. This is strident. This is excessive rhetoric. This is language that's insulting, to the police, when in fact the police just really literally did in New York, in a way, perhaps without the live ammunition, what the Egyptian army just did yesterday in Cairo to encampments of people who are protesting peacefully against the government's decision and just went in there and trashed everything. I heard an interview on CNN by a journalist whose passport was taken, whose computer was taken, who was beaten, by the Egyptian army just for being in the wrong place at the wrong time in their view.
Well, there were a number of journalists who were actually killed.
And you know, we've had this also. Certainly, I know about the journalist from Sky News, formerly with CNN, a cameraman who was killed. So, you know, you have an environment of official state terror that's erupting here. And it's much bigger. It's contagious. There's been a mysterious explosion in Lebanon, the headquarters of the Hezbollah in that area. There's been, of course, the continuation of the war in Syria, where it's been reported that there are over 600,000 jihadis, like al-Qaeda people, who have moved into Syria under the rubric, under the cover of, like, liberating the Syrians from an anti-democratic government. These people who have no respect for democracy, supported by monarchies that have no respect for democracy.
And there again, you have the same revolutionary playbook just ready to pop open. You know, assuming that they ultimately defeat Assad, the first thing's going to happen is just like the French Revolution and what's happening now in Egypt. You're going to have civil war there, and probably people will say, "Assad, come back so we can have order here." That's generally what happens.
I don't know if we're trying to reach Donna again. Have we tried to do that? We're not having any success.
She may be at the beach enjoying our show.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You get so absorbed listening to this show that I don't think it's possible to have other priorities.
Well, you know, at the same time, we're in an environment where it seems like all of this goes over people's heads in a way. They kind of resign to it. Well, look at what's happened. Didn't Bradley Manning apologize? All those people who were championing Bradley Manning were clearly wrong. Clearly, but Bradley Manning was trying to reduce a sentence that could be 90 years in prison. He was trying to show some remorse in a believable way. And the testimony was painfully touching by members of his family about his parents who were completely, alcoholics, about a 10-year-old who had to learn how to drive in order to take care of, Bradley Manning, about his, gender and identity issues, kind of a traumatized soul in many ways. And yet none of that seems to transcend the rancor, of prosecutorial zeal, the need to say, well, that's true, but what about this? There's no proof that because he is completely screwed up, that had any impact on his behavior.
Well, whether it does or not, I mean, come on, it's just not a defense, whatever the charge is, it's not a defense that you're screwed up. But either way, I mean, he doesn't deserve that level of prosecution.
Wait. How many people have come back from Iraq and shot themselves, shot members of their family, have acted out the traumatized experience that they've had there? I mean, the military is responsible for that.
My point is a tiny one. And if somebody comes back from Iraq, screwed up from the obvious, and he shoots up his family, he's got a great excuse, but...
Well, wait a minute. When you have a mass pattern of people who have post-trauma, and you see this pattern, you saw it in the Vietnam War, you saw it in the Iraq War, this is a direct relationship
Absolutely.
To the experiences
Absolutely.
That they had, the brutalized training and oversight that they experienced in the military, the way in which they were ordered to, in essence, to commit crimes, the guilt with which they're living. And you can't say, well, it's all their fault. They were a part of a machine, and that machine has to take some responsibility.
Well, that's not at all what I was saying. What I'm saying is that if somebody is homicidal, they can't walk around. How you treat them is another issue. It's smarter to treat their disease rather than just throw them away in a cell.
On the other hand, let's think about that, because You know, here we have people who have been really brutalized by a very brutalizing experience.
Sure.
And expected to act rationally. And then they're put in a court, a military court, where a judge is acting as a judge and jury, where the rules of military discipline and behavior are being imposed and as criteria of what is acceptable to talk about and what isn't acceptable to talk about. So you have no chance of sort of beating that system if the system itself is in a self-justifying way limiting the discourse.
Well, it's not even part of the justice system. So just to be discussing it on a you know, in the context of justice, you know, is ridiculous to begin with. The guy was railroaded into a 90-year sentence. He was not sentenced in a court of law under constitutionally mandated.
And my understanding is that the judge is going to get promoted now.
Well, sure.
For services rendered.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, one of my biggest problems here is the rigidity of Obama. Where did that come from? Or I guess it was always there. I don't know. I'm one of the jerks who drank the Kool-Aid, but the guy is a politician, so he acts like a politician, and somehow we thought we were voting for someone who's not a politician.
There's a notion called capture, that people get captured by the institutions that they're part of.
Yeah.
And, you know, you go right back to day one of the Obama administration. He's going into the Oval Office to sign a decree to close Guantanamo. This was his campaign promise.
Right.
And he goes into the office. We don't know what happened, but we know that when he came out of the office, Guantanamo was not closed. Clearly, he had a visit by some very high-level people in the Pentagon or in the defense committees in the Senate and House or whatever, and was told point blank, you cannot do this. And if you do this, the following things will happen. And he thought twice about it and didn't do it. And, you know, basically, you when you're in this position, you play you're playing to a certain audience. And in many cases, you're playing to a script that's been written by people, special interests, who have a clever way of sort of masking their self-interest and trying to make it appear as if this is what the country wants, this is what the country needs.
Right, but you hope that a leader's priorities is something beyond, like these precinct captains, something beyond their career track, their personal career track. And it just seems to be an impossibility that you have somebody that wants to lead a country in the West Wing sort of way.
Well, I'm curious about this also, about the whole way in which the national security state has expanded so dramatically under this administration. I mean, there's always been this spying. There's always been this national security agency prying into as much as it could pry into. But there did seem to be some limits, some sort of oversight, some sort of restraints and restrictions on what they could and couldn't do. Now all of that seems to be gone.
Yeah.
And what you have instead is a permanent bureaucracy armed with the latest technology and with the private sector companies in the telecommunications sphere essentially under orders to share all of our data, all of our private supposedly secure information with them whenever they want that information. And we're not told about it. And they're able to get away with it and bullying the private sector as well.
Yeah, and once you set up that profit-making infrastructure, then you cannot get rid of it, because those companies do not want to go out of business. So if for no other reason than to stay in business, you know, if a president says, I think we've gone a bit too far, let's stop this thing, you're going to have lobbyists on his ass, you know, 2 seconds later. You know, you can't do this. We have
the whole pretext of this, of course, is a section of the Patriot Act, that was passed after 9/11, an act which I think is something like 90% of the House of Representatives said they never read before they supported. They didn't want to appear to be unpatriotic.
Sure.
So they supported this Patriot Act, which without any debate or any discussion of its implications. And in fact, we're just learning through a Republican congressman that, in fact, information was not even given to the committees about what this was all about. So you have people supporting something, they didn't know what it was, they didn't have the data, didn't have the information, yet they were bullied into going along. And this is, unfortunately, a deeper pattern. You know, I did a series last year called Who Rules America, about the way in which the government is run by people outside the government, you know, and various special interest groups, military-industrial complex, the intelligence industries, the corporations, basically, that manage to resist regulation at every turn. And we're finding this increasingly. There was just a report today that the report issued by the Justice Department on the crackdown on mortgage violators was completely with figures were totally fudged and were completely, it was completely inaccurate. So we see this pattern continuing, and I, for one, am sick of it, Poehler. What can we do?
Well, we can have Donna Lieberman call.
Well, I guess Donna's not going to be with us this time.
But that's okay. There's important issues to discuss.
I think we're getting at some things here that are really important. We need a strategy for dealing with this national security environment. Okay. In my case, years ago, when I was in London in the 60s, the FBI and the CIA were monitoring my activities. I was a journalist then for a magazine called Ramparts. And, you know, I, under the Freedom of Information Act, when it was just passed, I saw my documents. They came back all blacked out, you know, redacted and all the rest of it. And, the bottom line of it was I also discovered that the National Security Agency had documents. And the National Security Agency refused to disclose those documents. So that's, you know, half a lifetime ago. So this is nothing new in a sense, but it is now news, which is a good thing. And at least there are people fighting back, which is a good thing. Whether or not the good guys will win, who knows? But we did see Obama agree to some sort of oversight and regulation, largely because of the efforts of Mr. Snowden, who he then later said, well, Mr. Snowden is not a patriot. John McCain compared him to Jason Bourne in the Ludlum books and movies because he's so popular with young people and all the rest of it. They don't know what to do, because every time they come up with, you know, a technology which they believe is completely undetectable and is top secret, and all these people have, you know, clearances on top of clearances on top of clearances, somebody manages to hack into it all.
Well, sure, with 800,000 people with security clearance, I think the odds are good you're going to have some leaks. You don't have so many damn secrets, and then you don't have to worry about so many damn secrets being revealed.
Well, on that note, I think we're going to leave this discussion for now. I hope you find it interesting. I certainly have been talking about it a lot, and welcome your comments to dissector@mediachannel.org. Mediachannel.org is back online. Please check it out. And also my blog at newsdissector.net, which is really the basis of this radio show, to talk about the issues that I talk about every day online. So visit the blog, check out mediachannel.org, and share any comments you might have with me, and I'll try to address them in future. Thank you for being here. We're back in a minute to talk about media and development. Meet Nyesha Lang to talk a little bit about the work she did in Belize, and hear some of the music and cultural stuff that she was involved in. It's really pretty inspiring.
First they're gonna stop and frisk, then they're gonna strip and search. They're gonna take you to Guantanamo and you'll disappear from the earth.
This is a call to the gifted. Do you want to be heard? Then where are your words? Come. Stop the bullets with your tongue. This is a call to the gifted. Do you want to be heard? This is a call to the gifted.
Where are you? Who are you? Come let
Let your voice be heard. Create something brand new.
Spoken word is one way to express what is going on with we. Use word sound power. Use dramatic body gestures to conjure deep emotion. Spoken word can show the people them how to change a thing. We must change. Positivity and power to all the youth.
Youth voices, youth expression and film. Come check us out at the Image Factory on Friday, January 7th at 7 p.m. A project by Global Parish in partnership with the U.S. Embassy in Belize.
Hey, there you are. The introduction to a program that our next guest was part of and is here to talk about, not only about that, but about the larger significance of trying to empower young people with music and culture and share what they're doing. They're already empowered by it, but share what they're doing with others. Naisha Lang, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
How are you? Pilar Levine in the house with us. Tell us a little bit about what we just heard and what you actually were doing in Belize.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for jamming along with me to that song. it actually worked for us. We were having a lot of fun when we recorded it, but it's great to see other people sharing that. I was in Belize for about 5 years. I went down to make a film about an artist named Andy Palacio, and I knew I wanted to stay. My family's from Belize, but I didn't really know how I'd be working down there, how to sustain myself. So I ended up finding a job with the government as an attorney. I'm an attorney and did that for a couple of years. But meanwhile, was sort of, you know, sort of had this urge to really do something more, have an impact. So I started this organization called the Global Parish Project, thinking that we would make films. And we ended up finding some youth who were talented, realizing we didn't have enough equipment. And talking to the youth, finding out what they really wanted to do, what they were all about, and realizing music, self-expression was a big part of who they were. And that if we wanted to get anywhere in terms of changing the culture down there, empowering the young people, we had to meet them where they were, and we would tell the stories about them.
Just tell us a little bit, for people who don't know, where Belize is and a little bit about the country. Because I've been there, you know, I had a great time there, but I'm wondering if everybody knows where Belize is and about the history of the country.
Right. Belize is on the Yucatan Peninsula of Central America, and it's considered a Caribbean country. Economically, politically, it's got ties to the rest of that region, but it's, you know, it's located next to Mexico, and it actually has a historical border dispute with Guatemala, which it's attached to by one border. And culturally, you know, it's a very diverse place. It's got people who look like me. They're called Creole, which is a mix of European and African and many other things thrown in there. And indigenous people, Maya, and mestizo people, other groups have come later. So really, it's quite a mix. It's quite a unique place in Central America.
It's also a big sightseeing destination for many people who, you know, go fishing or go diving. I mean, it has a vibe there that seems to attract people from all over the world because of its beauty and because of its natural resources.
Yeah, definitely. And it's been that way for a long time. Fortunately, Belize remained sort of pristine. It didn't, you know, there wasn't any big business. There wasn't any Dole, you know, fruit company or anything like that. So it remained sort of an agricultural, you know, economy and still is. But it was able to develop in terms of ecotourism. So there's a lot of, you know, natural beauty you can see if you go to Belize. There are the archaeological ruins. There's, you know, caves and all kinds of fun stuff to do. So, yeah, that's one of the claims to fame.
I went from Belize to into Guatemala, you know, to the Mayan, you know, area there that of the great, what are they called?
The Tikal ruin, yeah.
Tikal ruin. A fabulous, amazing thing to observe. But driving through Guatemala, you got a sense of why that country, you know, had the repression and wars that it did. I mean, military people were menacing even when there wasn't a war. But, you know, I did visit Guatemala right next door, you know, to Belize. And, you know, I really recommend people take this journey. It's a beautiful place to hang out and to enjoy as well, and to learn about this very unique culture.
Yeah, that's it's you know, it's so great to hear other people relating to it and having good experiences. What I found, actually, in my own experience, I went down, I thought I'd be there for like a year, I ended up there 5 years, and there's a large American retirement community down in Belize. Yeah. They go down, they go and visit, maybe on a cruise or something, they fall in love, and they end up staying for the rest of their lives, so... Social security
checks follow, which are probably worth a lot more there than here. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I think throughout the Caribbean, I found that there were a lot of senior citizens who, you know, really love, can stretch their dollars further and really like the vibe of the environment. Their families come to visit from time to time, but they have, you know, a whole new world, new life, you know, in a way.
Yeah, hopefully Belize doesn't drive them crazy and they don't find themselves running back to Texas or wherever they come from. One of the things, you know, the roads, I mean, it's like anywhere. I remember friends telling me from Texas that they used to drive to the airport just to feel what it felt like to ride on a smooth paved road and to drive. but yeah, I think most people fall in love with Belize.
Well, of course, what I'm curious about is what's the music like?
Sure, yeah. The music is very vibrant. But very diverse in a way that's still figuring itself out. That's my assessment, at least. So we've got a lot of raw, indigenous music. And then there's a lot of influence, musical influence from Jamaica in terms of the dance hall music, as well as more deeply the Rastafarian culture and reggae music historically. Then, if you go back even further, you had a lot of country, Western music infiltrating from American radio stations, satellite, and so forth. And you had other types of music, obviously, from North America coming in as well.
I always found it interesting because I studied Pan-African music. Mm-hmm. And what I found real interesting is that somehow Mexico got bypassed. Hmm. You know, as far as the African rhythm science taking root, because in most
for on the coast there.
Yeah, you know, Mexico mm-hmm. seemed
the
to
Costa
have been
Chica, right.
Yeah, Mexico seemed to have been more influenced by German music, by the big German. Connection. Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, even in Jamaica, I discovered quite a love of country music mm-hmm. on a lot of people's parts there. You know, they've kind of did reggae versions of country songs, Take Me Home, and others became big hits.
Yeah, there are parts of Africa where American country music is a big deal. I remember trading music with somebody from Ghana, and he had one of my favorite artists, Sekuba Bambino, and he wanted from me, what's his name? Williams, a famous country artist, and I had loads of his stuff, so I gave him piles of that, and he gave me, you know, the Sekuba Bambino stuff.
Well, let's hear one of the songs that you brought with you.
All right, so since we're talking about the more traditional music, well, we're not talking about that, but I mentioned the indigenous music. There's the Garifuna music, and that's really rich. There you've got Punta and Paranda music, and that's what my film was about. My film is called Punta Soul. So this song is called Liran Aban. It means everyone together. It's by the artist, the late great artist Andy Palacio.
Interpretation, or what's the language base of it?
That is Garifuna.
Garifuna.
Yeah.
And Garifuna is a historical language or a currently spoken language?
Yeah, that's a historical language. That language was formed in St. Vincent, in the island of St. Vincent, back in the 18th century. And it began as a product between the Carib and Arawak languages. As the Carib and Arawak soldiers were at war and with each other, and once the women were taken in, they would have to communicate with the men, and so they exchanged words, and there are words in the language, that some of which are feminine and some of which are masculine. And then, of course, it mixed with the African languages of the people who were free, the Maroon, basically, people on the island of St. Vincent, who became part of the Carib and Arawak Nation and were referred to as Black Caribs, now known as the Garifuna people. So that language has been evolving. It's also got, you know, French and Spanish words, and it's a really unique and studied by, you know, linguists all over the world. It's a very unique language, and it's the basis of this very rich culture that the Garifuna have.
The music seems to be this real interesting combination of Congolese and Jamaican.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's very Caribbean. That particular song's very rhythmic. It doesn't even sound really like a paranda to me. I'd have to get a musicologist to describe it better. But
it sounds a bit more traditional, well, African pop.
Yeah.
Than Jamaican pop. There's that bit of Jamaican backbeat in there, but what was pushing it forward? If you had another guitar in there, it might have almost sounded like soukous.
Yeah, it's true. Well, part of it is also the arrangement, though, because this is arranged by World Beat producers, one of the top producers in the Louise. His name is Ivan Duran.
Uh-huh.
And they use things like electric strings, guitars, like some of the Congolese artists use and the Senegalese artists use. And, as you know, not on that song, but they use things like flutes and, you know, other, you know, windwind instruments to kind of mix it up. But at the core, there's always the rhythms, the Garifuna rhythms. And the drums you're hearing are the primero drum and the segundo drum. But mostly the primero drum you're probably hearing, which is the bass line.
Uh-huh.
Let's see, I mean, all of this cultural mosaic, this mix, this fusion, you know, is really fascinating. And I think we need to appreciate and understand how diverse all of these cultures are and how they influence each other. You know, I was in Congo and in Kinshasa. You know, and Kinshasa is like a wild musical culture there. I mean, very, very, you know, kind of proud of the music that they've created, and these large bands and dance orchestras and all of this there that has been going for years and years and years.
Yeah, and it's evolving right here in New York. I have a great friend named Isaac Katale, who's playing with a band called the Lifelong Band, and they're playing the music of their parents and their grandparents in every bar they can find in Harlem, and it's wonderful because it's like an intergenerational experience listening to them.
Right.
Well, you know, we have a call. Let's hear who's on the line. I didn't really get it from Heather at the board here. Who is this? Hello. Donna Gleiberman, are you with us? Hello, where's Donna? She might not be able to hear. Oh, our board is messed up. Okay, folks, we're trying. It's like the first obstacle leads directly to the second obstacle, which morphs into the third obstacle, and so the guests can't be heard or can't be seen because we're not television, but they can't be heard. We are radio, and so that's a problem. Maybe we can get this fixed by next time. I hope so. Moving along, I guess, returning to Belize here, we thought we were going to take a little deviation into the courts of New York, but we can't seem to hear Donna, or she can't hear us. Well, can you, Donna?
Oh, now I can hear you.
Donna, is that you?
It's me. I'm sorry.
We thought you were listening to us on the beach at Cape Cod, you know, in Truro there or somewhere.
You're not far off.
Okay. Well, listen, you know, we're in Belize right now, but we're going to come back to New York City briefly because we really wanted to hear your take on the stop and frisk law. I know that we'll come back to this program. Okay. Kind of oozes along in different directions, but we have a lawyer with us in the studio and a musicologist and a news dissector all in one room. And of course, there was this decision that finally came down on stop and frisk. What's your take on it? What was good about it? What wasn't?
Well, this is a historic decision that's really the culmination of years of litigation about the NYPD's stop and frisk program that has really gone largely unchecked and is so far out of control that back in 2012, there were almost 700,000 stop and frisks, and 90% of the people stopped were so innocent that in an era of zero tolerance and broken windows policing, they all but 10% walked away without even a summons. And it's a program that targeted blacks and Latinos, and almost overwhelmingly, like 90%. And what the court said is, this is a program that's about racial profiling, and it, in many respects, violates the Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable searches and seizures, because stop and frisk, which is an important police tool, is limited, is supposed to be limited, to situations where there's suspicion of criminal behavior. And that's not the standard that police are using. They're using a high crime neighborhood or furtive.
There we go. All right, maybe she'll call back. This has been hard today, folks. Thanks for sticking with us. Thanks for being here. Your take on the stop and frisk decision?
I was trying to read it today. I need to read it. But what struck me is that the case, there are two cases. One of them was for the CCR, and the other was the New York Civil Liberties case, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know which is which. But the one that examines the police's policies in the street, not the one with the housing situation that they were monitoring people's movements in and out, that the police actually authorized this system of profiling, that, you know, a very detailed system of judging people as they encounter them on the street. And I think the other thing that came out was the percentage of those persons who were involved in the class action who actually ended up being innocent. And I think that, you know, there's so much rhetoric around this issue that people just assume that what's going on has sort of been, you know, has been accepted by law, has been accepted by the courts, and it's sort of the norm across the country. And, you know, I haven't lived in other states. Perhaps it is. But the point is that we sanctioned a program that discriminated against people, whether on its face or whether in its effect, and those people were innocent people. And
but so, our mayor, you know, says you're being unfair to him and to the police department. It's a one-sided decision, you know, and an unfair decision, because their motives are totally pure. They want to stop crime. They want to protect the public. And, you know, there's no evidence somehow that this is unconstitutional.
Right. I mean, and there's always been a gray line when it comes to whether the police have reasonable suspicion to stop someone, and then whether they have reasonable suspicion to search that person or the vehicle or some property on the person, you know. And I think courts will continue to struggle with that, those issues. But the bottom line is, it's too easy to create a program that allows an entire police force to profile an entire population.
But also, look how long this has taken to get into the courts, to actually get a decision. I mean, this has taken years, I think, of litigation, of various attempts to bring out the evidence, you know, document the case, present it to the courts, witnesses and people with experiences speaking about it, police attempting to squash it from even being heard, and they were successful in doing so for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And now this judge has ruled, and the judge did not completely, or maybe doesn't have the power to say that the law is totally unconstitutional and calling for reforms of the law and some sort of oversight and all the rest of it. But at the same time, it just shows you how difficult it is for people who are being aggrieved, if you will, or being abused, to actually get justice in the courts. It's not a simple matter.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And I mean, it's powerful that they were able to get this case brought as a class action. You know, I don't know
what does it take to get a class action recognized? In other words, to get a class recognized. Don, are you back with us? Hello. This is a bad day here. Hi. Hello. Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Okay, you're back with us. I'm sorry. We're trying to talk in lieu of your presence. But just in summary, what does this mean for the stop and frisk practices? Do they have to stop them, or are they going to be able to get the court to allow them to continue until an appeal is heard? What's the next step here?
The judge appointed a federal monitor who's supposed to, whose job it is to oversee, to set up the reforms and to ensure that there will be new training and new guidelines for stop and frisk. He's going to be charged with holding community forums to get input from the people who are affected by stop and frisk. So it's going to be a long process. The police are not barred from using stop and frisk, but they are supposed to follow the law, which is only to stop and frisk people who are suspicious of criminal activity.
So even
Donna. And the federal monitor isn't going to be in business tomorrow. It'll take a little bit of time, but I think we should be seeing some changes fairly soon.
Well, I'm still flabbergasted. I mean, a judge rules, you know, in a sense that these practices are violating people's rights, and yet the police are able to continue to violate people's rights somehow until some large-scale process is in place, which could take years.
You know, Danny, I'm having trouble hearing you. Let me make another point, and if I can't hear you better, then maybe you want to sign me off. But one of the parts of the remedy ordered by the court was a pilot program that involved one precinct, the highest stop and frisk precinct in each borough, where the police will be asked to put on body cameras to record their activities. And of course this raises some privacy concerns, but I think those can be dealt with clear guidelines in terms of, you know, how long, you know, what records are retained and who has access to them. But it's an important way, I think, to monitor what's going on in some of the most difficult precincts and to come up with guidelines and also to measure the impact of the changes that are made.
I'm rushing you, Donna. I have to jump in there. Hello, Donna.
Reference so that we can get in place the changes that are necessary to end this kind of, you know, practice of.
Thank you, Donna. I'm sorry I have to cut you off here because we're running out of time on the program. Thanks for finally joining us. I'm hoping we'll be able to do this again in the studio the next time and actually have this conversation because there's a lot of questions that have got unanswered and unasked, really, because we're out of time. This is News Dissector Radio. I'm Danny Schechter here with Paula Levine, Ayesha Lang. You know, it's been a disjointed program, but I hope you've enjoyed some of it. We're going to go out with a song, I hope, from Belize that we haven't heard yet. Thank you for listening. Write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. I'll have the podcast of this program in my blog tomorrow at newsdissector.net.
Yeah, so this song is called Black Guayabera, and it relates right back to the point, which is it's a song by a Belizean-American hip-hop artist. It talks about some of the challenges of youth in Belize who face police brutality and things like that and are struggling to survive every day in Belize. It's called Black Guayabera.
Let's hear it.
Babe, why do you do it?
Do what?
What you do?
What are you talking about?
Music.
Oh, music. I do it for the love. should ask me why I do it. You should ask me who I do it for.
So, who do you do it for?
I do it for the free tongue.